On the phone with us, we have Caitlin Rother. Caitlin has been so gracious to call us with updates during this civil trial with the Howe family. And Caitlin, you were in court today for the big verdict. And I was surprised, I'll be honest, because I thought Adam Schachnise would be found not responsible when I heard how quickly the jury came back. And I don't know what your thoughts are, but if you could just describe the courtroom and give us the scene, if you will, please, of what was going on when those verdicts were read.
Absolutely. The verdict, I think, came to a surprise to a lot of people, because I think they thought what you thought. In a criminal trial, when you have a criminal defendant up for murder and you get a quick verdict, it generally means that they're guilty. But in civil court, for some reason, people were thinking, and I talked to a number of other people who, you know, I'm sure would never say this publicly, and so I'm not going to name any names, but they, you know, they listened to all the evidence, and they thought, based on closing arguments, I guess, and the speed of the verdict, that it was going to be for the defense, because the guy, Dan Webb, you know, who is a very well-respected, very good attorney, very polished, he spoke loudly, he commands attention, he stood in the middle of the courtroom, gave his, you know, three-hour closing argument, and it was so loud I almost had to put my hands over my ears, and that's with no microphone. This is a former U.S. attorney, this is an attorney who President Trump has recently tried to get to represent him, and he refused, saying he was too busy. I have heard, and I don't know if this is true, that he earns something like $900 an hour doing what he does. So the defense was a highly paid, highly respected, you know, these attorneys are, you know, with big firms from all over the country, New York, Chicago, San Francisco. They had these huge staff in the sitting in the gallery. Jonas Schachnise was helping to subsidize this. He is either a very multimillionaire or, you know, a billionaire based on how much money he made from selling his company, which was $2.6 billion. So I think there were a lot of people who thought, you know, they have a lot of resources. They've got a lot of attorneys. They've got very expensive witnesses who have been flown out from all over the country. And he must have said 200 times, there is zero evidence against Adam Schachnise. There is no evidence that he had any participation or connection or responsibility for Rebecca Zahau's death. And so when the verdict came back after just 5 hours of deliberations, there were a lot of people who thought, like you did, that this was going to be a win for the defense. So basically, yesterday, this is another thing that happened in the afternoon, which was also, you could read it either way, but the jury went out around 11:30, dismissed the one alternate who was left, and they went into deliberations from 11:30 to 12, came back after a 98-minute lunch. They skipped their afternoon break. Now, I thought, and so did some other people, okay, that means they've already decided what they're going to do. They want to get out of there as quickly as possible. They want to reach a verdict, and that seems like it was going to be they were going to go with the defense. That's kind of what some people thought, because you know, it was a tough case. I have to say, it was a tough case to prove. Because they're really, how do you prove a negative? How do you prove that somebody committed murder when his DNA and fingerprints were nowhere to be found? So what I've been wanting to say, though, all this time was, you know, I wrote a book called Then No One Can Have Her with Steve DeMocker. I don't know if I mentioned this or not before, but he was convicted of killing his recently divorced wife of 35 days, because even though there was no evidence, fingerprints or DNA, so it's not like it never happens in criminal court. Sorry, we have a fire truck or an ambulance. So anyway, they didn't take their afternoon break, and so I thought, well, does that mean that they've made up their mind? it seems like that might not be so good for the plaintiffs. But then, a little while later in the afternoon, the jury sent a note to the judge, and it was basically, can we have some more information? Is there more information on these three items of collected evidence? They asked for these three numbers, item numbers, which had not actually been talked about during the trial. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. What are those? So Keith Greer hands me this list of items that the sheriff's investigators collected but did not test. And they were not pieces of evidence that anybody thought were pertinent in the trial by, either side. One was a tissue with red stains, which generally means blood, in the bathroom next to the guest bedroom where Rebecca was found hanging. Mm-hmm. The second thing was a pair of women's underwear that was found in the trash can in the guest house where Adam Shacknai was staying. And the third thing was a pair of latex gloves that were found in a crawl space in the steps to the basement. Now, my first thought was, wow, this jury is actually doing a pretty careful job. They are looking for holes in the case. Mm-hmm. They are looking for evidence to support murder, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I thought, well, wait a minute. Maybe they've thought it was suicide, but they're looking to make sure and they're doing their due diligence because maybe it could be murder. Or maybe they've decided it's murder and they are trying to cross their T's and dot their I's. But, either way, it was a very quick verdict. And so it's just... people were surprised this morning, you could see. And so when it came down, Keith Greer immediately hugged Mary Zahow, and that's the picture that'll be in the newspaper tomorrow because it basically just said everything. I was sitting next to Doug, Mary's husband, while we were waiting. The judge said at 10:10, she said, the jury's reached a verdict, and we were all looking at each other like, what does that mean? What does that mean? Because it was so fast,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And Keith Greer's like, well, that was pretty quick. That's crazy. It's quick. What does that mean?
Right.
So I was talking to Doug, and he goes, well, it's just so obvious to me, what happened, and what do you think? And I said, well, in criminal court, if it's fast, it usually means it's not good for the defense. But in civil court, I think it might mean the opposite. I said, but you never know. You can't know what a jury is going to do.
Right.
And so he was shaking. He was anxious. He was so, nervous. And, he had to get up and leave and come back in. And, so it was tense while we were waiting because all the attorneys were already in the courtroom. But we had to wait for the media. So the media all filed in. And the jury came in. The jury wouldn't look at Keith Greer or Mary Zahow. So I thought, well, that's a sign.
Yeah.
That's a sign that they didn't vote in their favor, right? But then they started reading off the verdicts, and I was just like, oh my God, they were, the first question was, the battery. So they had to find that he touched her with the intent to harm her. That's the first question. And then if you say yes on this one, you go to the next question. Mm-hmm. And they're, two separate verdict forms, one on the battery charge and one on the wrongful death charge. And the first one right off the bat was yes. And we, Keith Greer turned around and looked at Doug and, big thumbs up. And
yeah, I saw that picture. That's a great picture too.
Yeah, yesterday, I don't know if you heard this, but Keith Greer was giving his rebuttal or starting to give his rebuttal. And he started trying to talk about what Rebecca Zahow's last words would have been to the jury. And he couldn't get into it because the defense objected, and he just suddenly was overcome with emotion, and he stopped, he turned around, he paced a little bit, he turned back around. I mean, he just looked so uncomfortable and struggling. And then he just kind of finished his his statement and sat down.
It's very
and I
short.
Thought to myself, I thought to myself, that's not what he planned to do. Something happened. And he said, Mary, you know, you shouldn't have said that to me right before because now I'm all emotional. And so basically what happened is he got so choked up he couldn't finish his planned rebuttal. He had 12 pages of things he was going to, you know, reinforce for the jury. But as it turned out, he didn't need to. So.
Well, exactly. And I think, to me, in my professional legal opinion, which means nothing, of course, because I have no legal background, but
right.
I would think that the fact that the judge would not split the question, I think that had a big part of it, because if they believed it was murder, and they did, the only other thing they could vote for was that Adam was basically responsible. So
well, that's an interesting way to look at it, because I was thinking the opposite, that what if they thought that it was murder, but they didn't see any evidence that Adam did it, and he would be an innocent man, and how could they do that if they weren't sure?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, maybe they looked at it the way you did. So
that's, you know, and like I said, it's as he's not going to prison. He's not, you know, it will affect.
He's not going to jail.
He's not going to jail. But I don't know if that's it. That's just my ideas. Okay, well, even though we don't see any evidence, the only one that could have done it logically was Adam.
Right.
And I think the other thing, the DNA, I think that what helped that DNA argument was the fact that the things Adam admitted to touching did not have
DNA. Right, didn't have DNA. Exactly,
so I think those
exactly.
Two things just
played,
just interlocked and worked perfectly for the family. Do you know, is there going to be any statements coming forth or anybody going to be talking to the press in a press conference?
Well, yeah, they did one this morning. Keith Greer and Mary. Oh, you saw that? Okay, so tomorrow, I guess, Dan Webb is going to give a press conference.
Okay.
That's all I know. But I taped. You saw the one from this morning?
One. It was the one where they took a quick break before they decided the punitive. Was that it? It was just a quick break, and they came out and started talking to the reporters, and then had to go back in.
Was it in the hallway? Was it in the hallway?
Yeah.
Okay. I videotaped on my cell phone. There was a news conference after the verdict. They had a hearing on the punitive damages thing, which they didn't finish, which is why I have to go back in at 3:00 because I'm confused on what's going on exactly. There was objections by the defense. They didn't even think there should be punitive damages or a phase two because they object to everything no matter what. But they were trying to, you know, they're bringing up all kinds of arcane citations from different, you know, law, previous case law and precedents. They're claiming, you know, this and that. And so what the judge said to the jury was, I'm not discharging you. I'm letting you go for the day. We need you to come back tomorrow. There may be some other issues we need to for you to take up. So she didn't even talk to them about punitive damages. But what Keith Greer said to them in his closing argument, not the rebuttal, but the closing, was essentially, here's what I'm asking for, a penny for the, you know, the tube of paint, the value of the paint. So nominal damages for that and economic damages. So, but also, I don't know if you're aware of this, the jury awarded Rebecca's mother $35,000 for the past of money that Rebecca would have sent her.
Right.
And then $130,000, something like that, for the future. And then $2 million and $3 million for, you know, the loss of love and affection and what have you, economic damages in the future. But the punitive damages, Keith Greer left open and said, I can't put a value on that. I'm going to just leave that up to you, the jury. So they must know that that's still hanging.
Right.
But the judge left it open and said, we may need you. So I guess there is some kind of issue of whether or not this phase two is going to go ahead or how it's going to go ahead. If is it really going to be like a little tiny trial with testimony, or are they just going to give the jury some instructions and send them back into the room to come back with a number? I'm not quite sure on that yet. I also was wondering, is there a chance that they could settle? And so I asked Keith Greer and Mary and Doug at the news conference this morning, you know, previously you said that this wasn't, you know, about money, and would you settle at this point? And Keith said, I guess, I mean, our job is done here. We got the verdict. So I asked the spokesperson for the defense team, and she said, well, they're going to talk about that this afternoon, but if they settle, they can't appeal, which tells me that they're going to appeal, which is obvious. Mm-hmm. I mean, duh, why wouldn't I think of that? But I just thought, well, maybe because they've already given $5 million, maybe they want to settle or try to settle with the house for another, you know, $5 million or something, mm-hmm. in case the jury awards some whopping figure, knowing that Jonah Shackney has so much money. Yeah. However, this case isn't against Jonah Shackney. It's right. against yeah. Adam Shackney. No, and he doesn't have the kind of money, mm-hmm. you know, that his brother does. And just because it's his brother doesn't mean he has access to that money, even though I'm sure Adam and Jonah are close, or maybe they're not, I don't know, but mm-hmm. Jonah probably would give him money if he had to, but he's made it clear so far, and Keith Greer even mentioned this, you know, he even said on 2020 that he's never giving that Greer guy any money, not a single
right.
dollar.
Oh, yeah,
so anyway, yeah, it was, I don't think the defense thought they were going to lose. I really don't.
Thank you, right.
I mean, I think they've thought all the way along, we can outman them, we can outgun them, we can outstaff them, we can outwitness mm-hmm. them. It's big.
Right.
It's a big, big, big news here in San Diego, because it's not just a victory for the Zahau family. It is, I think, a black eye for the sheriff's department.
Because
this is really questioning. I mean, they won this case based on claims that the investigators, you know, basically had confirmation bias, that they had tunnel vision, and that they had a theory, and they only saw the theory through the filter of that suicide theory. Now, where did the suicide theory come from is my question.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why that, and why not homicide?
Exactly.
Was there some kind of outside pressure? You know, that,
mm-hmm.
that I've heard that. I've heard that Jonah Shackney, you know, said to them, you know, you're hurting my company's reputation by dragging my name through this, saying it was my house, and, you know, you're affecting my employees' pension fund. I mean, I've heard that he said that to the sheriff's department, and I don't know for sure that that's true, but I did hear that from more than one source.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that had anything to do with it. The sheriff's department has always claimed that, you know, it was very thorough and
mm-hmm.
did a good job. 40-page autopsy report is a pretty long autopsy report. So they.
But I think also the thing that hurt them, Caitlin, is the fact that they had the medical examiner on schedule, and then they didn't call him. And Keith Greer told me, and I agree, they didn't call him because they saw what Keith Greer did to all of the other law enforcement people that got up there. He tore holes into their testimony, and the defense
right.
didn't want that happening to the medical examiner. I am not sure how this works, but I would assume everybody knew the medical examiner was coming up. I would assume that that would include the jury. And if they knew that,
I don't think the jury knew that.
Okay.
I want to point out one thing that I have. Sure. I don't think I've had a chance to do on TV or on Facebook or anywhere else. The guy that they called instead, his name was
mm-hmm.
Dr. Davis. I believe it's Davis or Davies. I think Davis. He is at the University of Kentucky. He was unpaid as a witness because he gets a salary from the university.
Mm-hmm.
And part of his responsibilities is to take on cases like this and to basically, you know, make either do research or investigate or give testimony or whatever. So he couldn't be considered a quote unquote paid witness. And he was brought in, and Dan Webb mentioned this during his closing. We were going to have, Dr. Luskas come in. I'm not sure if he actually said that, but we knew that he was going to, But we decided we were going to have this guy come in instead because we wanted to have an outside person come in and give the jury, give you the jury, an idea of, you know, how an outside, give an outside perspective of what kind of job he did. And they never mentioned, and I did this research myself. I looked the guy up, online, and guess what? He did a fellowship at the San Diego County Medical Examiner's Office.
That's it.
So
really?
In terms of being an outside person, he's not. Part of his training was done at the San Diego County Medical Examiner's Office. So that, to me, is a potential conflict of interest that should have been disclosed to the jury and wasn't.
Right.
And all anybody had to do was Google it. And then I know the jury's not supposed to do that, but any media that was covering this could have discovered it just like I did. I just didn't get a chance to say it because, you know, I'm not a full-time media person and I'm on the air and I only have so much time to say certain things that they want to ask me. So that's what I need to tell you right now.
So Google is our friend. Let's remember that,
exactly.
People. Google is our friend. So that is very interesting, Caitlin.
So he was not an outside legitimizing person at all because he was backing up, you know, he was backing up somebody that, you know, that worked for an agency that helped in his own training. And so I think you might be right in terms of they were scared of what was going to happen with Dr. Lucas on the stand, but I think they also wanted to create the impression and the appearance that they were legitimizing the report by someone else more than they
right.
I think that's just as likely a reason as it was that they were worried how he was going to do. So
right. Well, maybe it's a little bit of both. They were worried about he would do
it. Yeah,
hey,
maybe.
We can even make it better. We can have this guy in and make it look like Oh,
exactly.
This will be very, very interesting. I'm assuming, unless, like you said, the defense settles, which I doubt, I'm assuming they're going to appeal, and the appeals will probably take a long time. But the big question, Caitlin Rother, and you, your opinion means a lot to us.
Okay, good.
Do you think they are going to reopen a law enforcement investigation of this case, maybe not with the sheriff's department, but maybe with another agency? What are your thoughts?
You know, that's what Mary wants. Keith Greer was standing, you know, it was after the verdict, and he's like, wow, what do I do now? What do I do with my life now? I've spent 5 years on this. Mary goes, got to work on reopening the case. You know?
There you go. Yeah.
And so that's what they're going to be set on doing. They have tried doing this before. They tried getting the Attorney General's office involved. They tried getting the sheriff to reopen. They wouldn't do it. They have solidly stood by this decision. The everybody on the stand from the sheriff's office, whether they're former or current personnel, all stood by the suicide conclusions and the party line. I mean, I have no idea what the sheriff's department would do. I would think that politically it would be a smart thing for them to at least take another look. But they were just so adamant about this being a suicide. I suspect that even if they did reopen it, that they would still stick by what they originally did. So it may not be in the House's best interest to try to get the sheriff's department. Maybe they really do need to try again a different agency, maybe try another stab at the Attorney General's office, because I just feel like, you know, they just truly believe that this was a suicide, and they're basing it a lot on, I think, those notes on her phone. And the very last defense witness was this clinical psychologist, Alan Berman, I think that was his name, who basically went through all those notes and analyzed them all for the jury with this retrospective suicide assessment risk factors, and basically was very convincing, I thought, that she really could have done this to herself in a number of very seemingly, you know, his reasons made a lot of sense, you know. I have a psychology degree, so I totally saw what he was saying. It doesn't mean it's true, But everything he said I thought was very persuasive and very convincing. And for maybe another person, it definitely would have been true. But Rebecca the House family said this isn't who she was.
If you don't mind,
I didn't know her. It's hard to say.
I know you're short on time, but can you just give us like the Reader's Digest version of what this doctor said those notes meant on Rebecca's phone?
Basically, there were two notes. One, I think we've talked about this before, but there was one that was a letter written to Jonah, which she probably never sent. So, you know, that's a therapeutic tool that counselors recommend. Write a letter to someone, never send it. So she basically said, you know, she was very upset that he wasn't supporting her more in her dealings with his two ex-wives and his children by these women. The biggest problem was the oldest teenage daughter who she felt was very disrespectful to her. Jonah testified about that as well, saying that it was a very uncomfortable situation for him because Rebecca clearly did not get along with her and vice versa. And with, you know, some of these things this girl would say, according to Jonah, were completely neutral and Rebecca would still react to them and be upset. And then there were other times where she did say things that were understandably upsetting. And then she also had problems with Dina, his most current ex-wife. I guess there was some sort of issue over Max's not eating, and that's because Rebecca was such a health nut and so diet conscious that she was making, you know, telling Max, you know, you shouldn't eat those cookies and, you know, don't eat sugar. There was a lot of conflict there. And then when Dina testified in the video testimony, you could tell that she didn't really respect Rebecca's clothing choices, and she was trying to say it in a way that didn't sound offensive, but she basically, I think, thought that she showed too much skin. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
She said she said something about her clothes being so small or something, you know? So clearly there was conflict there, and so the letter to Jonah basically went into, you know, that she was just really upset with him for not, you know, taking her side and supporting her more in all of those dealings. And then there was a second letter, which wasn't, I don't think, written to anyone in particular, but it was still sort of written in that same format, where she basically described that she wasn't sleeping, that she was crying all the time, that she felt like it was her fault, she had no life, she had been isolated, she had let herself be that way, you know, basically let Jonah rule her life. She said, no amount of money is worth what I'm going through. For the first time in my life, I can't sleep. All I can do is think and cry and, you know, my life is worth, it has no value. And, I mean, it really, I can see why someone would think that, you know, clearly was a depressed person. She has no confidant. She has no one to confide in or talk to other than her family, whom she never really talked to about these kinds of matters anyway, because she didn't want to worry her mother, I think, and she didn't want to really talk about those kinds of intimate details with her mom. You know, they sung hymns together and talked about God and, you know, all, you know, religious kinds of things, and so mom's not the kind of person she's going to confide in, and so she was clearly not in a good state, and so that's what the psychologist was basing his opinions on, and he completely agreed that it was suicide, and that he said that last voicemail that Jonah says he left for her, which of course we have never heard, and the sheriff's never heard, he just took Jonah's word for it, because they didn't get it in time before it was removed from the server, that basically, you know, that was the last straw. And that's when she heard the message that he left for her saying that Max will probably never walk or talk again, that's when she decided to commit suicide. And that's what Alan Berman completely agreed with, that whole scenario. And
well, Caitlin, listen, I know you have to go. I don't want to make you miss your next interview, but we'll be talking to you again soon because you're writing a book about this, right?
Yes, I'm at this point still definitely gathering material for a book. I hope to be able to write a book. I want to write a book. I think it's a fascinating case. I think there's a lot of interest in it.
Caitlin Rother, thank you so much. You can go to caitlinrother.com. All of your books are there. You're a New York Times bestselling author. You have been wonderful to Web Sleuths during this trial, but I'm sure we'll talk again real soon because things still aren't 100% settled, so we'll be talking again, okay?
Okay, sounds good. Thanks so much.
Take care, Caitlin. Talk to you soon now.
You too. All right.
Bye-bye.
Oh, man, what a day. And guess what? Not over yet. We just heard from Caitlin Rother, and we are waiting for a phone call from Keith Greer. He's the family attorney for the Zahau family. He's the victor today. And I'm telling you, it's been a wild ride, especially yesterday during the closing arguments. Keith Greer looked like he had a lot more to say, and then he was too emotional to say it. And I can't wait to hear him talk about that and more. So he's promised me that he will call sometime today. Now, if he doesn't, you know I am not above smacking that guy upside the head. I'll smack anybody upside the head. But we'll give him a break if he can't make it today. I'm sure it'll be first thing tomorrow. So keep your fingers crossed. Look for that link with the interview with Keith Greer coming up at any time. And, of course, you can spend your time on websleuths.com. There's so much to do there, so much to read, and so much to become involved with. Websleuths.com. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.